Yesterday was a day of grief, shock, and anger in Minneapolis after a heavily armed assailant shot through the stained glass windows of Annunciation Catholic Church, where children and adults gathered for Mass early Wednesday to celebrate the first week of school.
An 8-year-old child and a 10-year-old child were killed in the pews of that church. 14 more children were wounded, along with 3 adults. By nightfall, hundreds of people came together to mourn at vigils across the city in a nearby school gym. In a city park, the shooter has been identified as a 23-year-old former student. Authorities say they shot themselves behind the church.
The witnesses to yesterday's violence were young, like the victims. Here's 10-year-old Weston Halsney speaking to a local television station, Care 11.
I just ran under the pew, and then I covered my head. My friend Victor, saved me, though, because he laid on top of me. But he got hit.
His friend Victor, he says, was shot in the back, but he says he's okay.
For the latest on what we know about this killing spree, we turn to reporter Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio, who was at the scene throughout the day. Good morning, Matt.
Hi, Layla.
Matt, what else do we know about where this happened and the people who were shot and wounded?
The church and school are an institution in South Minneapolis. Annunciation celebrated its 100th anniversary a few years ago. The victims spanned generations. In addition to the children who were hurt and killed, 3 parishioners in their 80s were also wounded. Police Chief Brian O'Hara says the 2 children killed were pronounced dead at the scene, but he says the prognosis is good for the 17 people who were wounded.
All of the remaining victims are expected to survive. There is a range of injuries, however.
Officials said Wednesday that multiple children were taken to Hennepin County Medical Center in critical condition. A spokesperson for another hospital, Children's Minnesota, said that 7 children were admitted there and 4 had been discharged by late afternoon. The father of a kindergartner at Annunciation told me yesterday that his son's class was not at the church service and the children there were able to shelter in place in their classroom.
Still very terrifying for them. Were you able to talk with any witnesses to this attack?
Pat Scallon is an alum of Annunciation School. He's still a parishioner there and lives down the block in the house where he grew up. Scallon said he thought at first that the gunshots were a roofing crew with pneumatic nail guns, but he realized quickly that it was rifle fire. Scallon says he ran to the scene just as several injured children were coming out of the church. He stayed with them until the first of many ambulances arrived. Scallon says he helped a boy who suffered a wound to his arm and a girl with a neck wound.
She was conscious, her eyes were good, and she was just a brave little. Then there was another boy who got grazed in the arm, I think, another brave kid. They were all around 4th or 5th grade.
So authorities have identified the suspect. What do they know about the person they say carried out this attack?
The shooter was named as Robin Westman. Chief O'Hara said the 23-year-old was outside the church and fired through windows into the building. Westman was armed with a rifle, pistol, and shotgun and died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound at the rear of the church. O'Hara said the shooter purchased all of the weapons legally and recently. Westman left behind a video that was scheduled to post to YouTube at the time of the shooting. O'Hara said it appeared to show Westman at the scene and included some disturbing writings. The chief says the FBI worked with YouTube to have the video taken down.
And how are leaders consoling their community in this moment?
As we heard, there were vigils Wednesday night. Another is set for this evening at the Basilica of St. Mary, a large Catholic church in downtown Minneapolis. At a news conference, standing alongside the police chief, mayor, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz on Wednesday, Archbishop Bernard Hebda read a message from Pope Leo XIV, who said he was, quote, profoundly saddened to learn of the loss of life and injuries in the shooting, and he sends his heartfelt condolences to everyone affected.
That's Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you for your reporting, Matt.
You're welcome.
The Department of Health and Human Services says the new director of the Centers for Disease Control has been fired.
HHS announced Wednesday that Susan Menares was no longer CDC director, less than a month after being sworn in. Hours later, though, attorneys representing Menares posted on X that she had not resigned or been notified by the White House that she had been fired.
NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to explain. Good morning, Selena.
Morning, Leila.
So first, just remind us who Suzanne Monares is and her path to CDC director.
Well, she's a microbiologist who's held several roles as a career scientist in the federal government. She was President Trump's second choice to lead the agency after former Congressman Dave Weldon, who couldn't get enough support in the Senate. So Monares did get through the Senate confirmation process. She was sworn in on July 31st, and she came in to lead a public health agency that suffered major staff and budget cuts, that's been disparaged by members of the Trump administration. Then in her first week on the job, a gunman fired hundreds of bullets into the agency and a police officer was killed.
So then what happened Wednesday?
Well, first, the Washington Post reported that Monares was out. The Department of Health and Human Services confirmed that reporting a few hours later. The Post on X said that, quote, "Susan Monares is no longer director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We thank her for her dedicated service to the American people."
But that's not the end of it, right?
Yeah, right. So just after HHS posted that, at least five really extremely senior career scientists at CDC announced their resignations. They include the agency's chief medical officer, the director of the Center on Emerging Infectious Diseases. Several wrote scathing resignation letters, including Dimitri Daskalakis, who directed the Center on Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases. He shared his letter on X and said that no expert from his center had ever briefed Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on measles or bird flu or anything else, and said, "I'm not sure who the secretary is listening to, but it is not us." And he also wrote, quote, "Having to retrofit analyses and policy actions to match inadequately thought-out announcements in poorly scripted videos or page-long X posts should not be how organizations responsible for the health of people should function." And then, a twist, attorney Mark Zaid shared on social media he was representing Susan Monares and she had not resigned. And late last night, he wrote in a statement that, quote, "As a presidential appointee, Senate-confirmed officer, only the president himself can fire her. For this reason, we reject notification that Dr. Monares has received as legally deficient, and she remains as CDC director. We have notified the White House counsel of our position."
And really quickly, what spurred all of this?
Well, I spoke to a senior CDC leader. It sounds like there was a meeting late last week with HHS leadership that went very badly. And what this does is it leaves CDC without a director and without really senior staff leaders at a time when the agency is really struggling.
That's NPR's Selena Simmons Duffin. Thank you, Selena.
Thank you.
We have some exclusive reporting now from NPR. Our reporters have been speaking to more than two dozen former senior Biden administration officials. All were directly involved in shaping U.S. policy towards Israel's war in Gaza.
This comes as Israel's war against Hamas nears the two-year mark. There is now a humanitarian crisis for the 2 million Palestinians living there. We wanted to learn more about what role the U.S. as Israel's strongest ally may have had in trying to get aid into Gaza to alleviate that crisis.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf was one of the reporters working on this, and she joins me now. Good morning, Kat.
Good morning.
Okay, so the reporting really took you all behind the scenes for some dramatic months in the Biden administration and in this war. Tell us more about who you talked to and what you heard.
Yeah, I did this reporting with our colleagues Fatma Tanis and Tom Bowman. And the people we talked to were senior officials across the administration. Many of them requested anonymity in order to speak candidly with us about sensitive internal discussions. And what they described was a sometimes contentious atmosphere within the administration about the decisions being made. And now many are grappling with this idea of, did the U.S. do enough? Some people we talked to said the Biden administration prevented famine from occurring in Gaza, which has been declared since President Trump took office. One senior former official told us, quote, "Nobody can say we did enough. You can say we made a difference. It could have been worse." But others argued that's not the standard by which to measure success here.
So it sounds like there was debate within the administration about how U.S. policy was shaped on getting food into Gaza. How did that play out?
Well, the people we talked to described strong, sometimes bitter arguments about how far the U.S. was willing or able to go to pressure Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You know, some believed the U.S. needed to use all of its leverage to push Israel to let more aid in, including possibly withholding U.S. weapons. And others believed in giving Israel space to conduct its war with Hamas, especially in the early days when the trauma of the October 7 attacks on Israel was still very fresh. There was also a lot of frustration with Israel within the administration when it came to how much humanitarian aid it was allowing into Gaza, with heated arguments between senior U.S. officials and their Israeli counterparts. You know, very senior Biden officials, including the president himself, would spend hours on the phone with Israel pushing on specific aid details, the number of trucks getting in on one day or a crossing being opened, for example. And officials told us that this meant that the U.S. was often bogged down, sometimes losing the bigger picture. Here's Elisa Ewers, a former U.S. official involved in the early planning. Here's what she told us.
The situation on the ground was so dire that you were always playing catch up. You were always trying to get ahead of the problem when, in fact, you were very far behind.
Okay, so Kat, that was then. What's happening now with U.S. policy and the humanitarian situation in Gaza?
Well, now the U.S. under the Trump administration largely seems to be allowing Israel to do what it wants. Aid groups on the ground told us that the U.S. is no longer exerting the same kind of consistent round-the-clock pressure on Israel to allow more aid into Gaza as it did under the Biden administration. A White House official told NPR that Trump, quote, wants to ensure the people of Gaza are fed. But, you know, regardless of the administration, one former senior U.S. official told us that they thought the tragedy of Gaza has fundamentally compromised American global standing. They said, quote, it's a stain which everyone in the world sees, even if we don't.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.